Arthur and Fenchurch could feel them, wispy, cold and thin, wreathing round their bodies, very cold, very thin. They felt, even Fenchurch, now protected from the elements by only a couple of fragments from Marks and Spencer, that if they were not going to let the force of gravity bother them, then mere cold or paucity of atmosphere could go and whistle. The two fragments from Marks and Spencer, which was Fenchurch, rose now into the misty body of the clouds, Arthur removed very, very slowly, which is the only way it's possible to do when you're flying and also not using your hands, went on to create considerable havoc in the morning in, respectively, counting from top to bottom, Isleworth and Richmond. They were in the cloud for a long time, because it was stacked very high, and when finally they emerged wetly above it, Fenchurch slowly spinning like a starfish lapped by a rising tide pool, they found that above the clouds is where the night gets seriously moonlit. The light is darkly brilliant. There are different mountains up there, but they are mountains with their own white Arctic snows. They had emerged at the top of the high-stacked cumulonimbus, and now began lazily to drift down its contours, as Fenchurch eased Arthur in turn from his clothes, prized him free of them till all were gone, winding their surprised way down into the enveloping whiteness. She kissed him, kissed his neck, his chest, and soon they were drifting on, turning slowly in a kind of speechless T-shape, which might have caused even a forlornest fire dragon, had one flown past replete with pizza, to flap its wings and cough a little. There were, however, no forlornest fire dragons in the clouds, nor could there be, for, like the dinosaurs, the dodos, and the greater drubbered wintwock of Stegbartle Major in the constellation Fraz, and unlike the Boeing 747, which is in plentiful supply, they are sadly extinct, and the universe shall never know their like again. The reason that a Boeing 747 crops up rather unexpectedly in the above list is not unconnected with the fact that something very similar happened in the lives of Arthur and Fenchurch a moment or two later. They are big things, terrifyingly big. You know when one is in the air with you. There is a thunderous attack of air, a moving wall of screaming wind, and you get tossed aside if you are foolish enough to be doing anything remotely like what Arthur and Fenchurch were doing in its close vicinity, like butterflies in the Blitz. This time, however, there was a heart-sickening fall or loss of nerve, a regrouping moments later, and a wonderful new idea enthusiastically signalled through the buffeting noise. Mrs. E. Capelson of Boston, Massachusetts, was an elderly lady. Indeed, she felt her life was nearly at an end. She had seen a lot of it, been puzzled by some, but she was a little uneasy to feel at this late stage, bored by too much. It had all been very pleasant, but perhaps a little too explicable, a little too routine. With a sigh, she flipped up the little plastic window shutter and looked out over the wing. At first she thought she ought to call the stewardess, but then she thought, no, damn it, definitely not. This was for her, and her alone. By the time her two inexplicable people finally slipped back off the wing and tumbled into the slipstream, she had cheered up an awful lot. She was mostly immensely relieved to think that virtually everything that anybody had ever told her was wrong. The following morning, Arthur and Fenchurch slept very late in the alley, despite the continual wail of furniture being restored. The following night, they did it all over again, only this time with Sony Walkman. Chapter 27. "This is all very wonderful," said Fenchurch a few days later, "but I do need to know what's happened to me. You see, there's this difference between us, that you lost something and found it again, and I found something and lost it. I need to find it again." She had to go out for the day, so Arthur settled down for a day of telephoning. Murray Bost Henson was a journalist on one of the papers of small pages and big print. It would be pleasant to be able to say he was none the worse for this, but sadly this was not the case. He happened to be the only journalist that Arthur knew, so Arthur phoned him anyway. "Arthur, my old soup spoon, my old silver tureen, how particularly stunning to hear from you. Someone told me you'd gone off into space or something." Murray had his own special kind of conversation language, which he had invented for his own use, and which no one else was able to speak or even to follow. Hardly any of it meant anything at all. The bits which did mean anything were often so wonderfully buried that no one could ever spot them slipping past in the avalanche of nonsense. The time when you did find out, later, which bits he did mean, was often a bad time for all concerned. "What?" said Arthur.